I'm David Vaughan, and today I bring you a special programme to mark the Czech national holiday. It's the anniversary of the foundation of Czechoslovakia on October the 28th, 1918. Today we're going to be talking about the first Czechoslovak Republic, which existed for the 20 years that followed the foundation of the country. Now, for 40 years under communism, the First Republic was more or less a taboo subject. It was portrayed as a period of wild capitalism, of exploitation of workers, and also as a country that was unable to stand up to Hitler. With the fall of communism, the pendulum swung the other way, and the First Republic was often seen as a golden age in the history of the country. Now, in this program, exactly 90 years after the foundation of Czechoslovakia and nearly two decades since the fall of communism, I'll be discussing the legacy of the First Republic with the historian, journalist and broadcaster Ondřej Houska, who will soon be leaving to become Czech Radio's correspondent in Brussels, and also by one of the Czech Republic's most distinguished sociologists, a man whose childhood memories go back to the First Republic, Professor Jiří Musil. Thank you both very much indeed for joining us today in the studio.
Hello.
Hello.
I think it would be rather interesting to start, especially given that it's the 70th anniversary this autumn of the signing of the Munich Agreement, to start with that moment. Here's an archive recording of the British Prime Minister, Neville Chamberlain, on his return to London after the Munich Agreement had been signed, which of course meant effectively the end of Czechoslovakia, the end of the First Republic, when Germany annexed the Sudetenland. This is 70 years ago on September the 30th, 1938.
The settlement of the Czechoslovakian problem, which has now been achieved, is, in my view, only the prelude to a larger settlement in which all Europe may find peace.
Now, that was an extremely jubilant Neville Chamberlain. Of course, the peace that he was talking about didn't last very long. And what is so shocking is how the first Czechoslovak Republic fell apart, disintegrated more or less immediately. Professor Musil, how do you think that was possible, that this really very solid democratic country, seemingly, so quickly fell apart?
There were elements or groups of people who were extremely loud at that time. I mean, the right-wing nationalists, the Catholics, people who were from the beginning on the side of the First Republic, but then changed a bit their mind. And they accused...
You're talking about Czechs here, not
yes,
about
I'm
Germans
talking about Czechs here. And they attacked the supporters of the First Republic, or the pillars of the Republic. And these other group, the pillar people, were in a kind of shock. That has to be admitted.
And Ondřej Houska, why do you think the Republic fell apart so easily? Was it simply because it was betrayed by its key allies? That was one of the key points of the foreign policy of Czechoslovakia, wasn't it? The support of Britain and France, and without them, obviously, the country was considerably weakened.
Well, I would not say that it fell apart so easily. We have to keep in mind that the Republic was under extremely heavy pressure from outside, at least from 1933. So for some years, it stand alone against the totalitarian dictatorship. But we have to keep in mind as well that the pressure from outside was decisive. Without that pressure, the Republic would have never fallen apart. So when I see that some people portray the Czechoslovak history in a way that it was doomed to failure from the beginning, that all the Versailles settlement created in 1919-1920 was doomed to failure, that's a complete misunderstanding. Even German historians now say that there were some promising development when it comes to Czech-German relations in Czechoslovakia back in the second half of 1920s. So that's the reason. The outside pressure from Nazi Germany was the reason, and the failure of Western democracies to grasp the importance of defending Czechoslovakia against Hitler.
And I'd like to take this opportunity to play another archive recording. This is very interesting because it's Hitler speaking in the Sportpalast in Berlin just before the meeting in Munich where Czechoslovakia was carved up. So let's hear a short extract from his speech, which I shall try roughly to translate.
Dieser Herr Finde trat damals in Versailles auf und versicherte zunächst, dass es eine tschechoslowakische Nation gebe.
Effectively, what Hitler is saying here is that at the time when Czechoslovakia came into being, Beneš, who of course wasn't yet president at that time, claimed that there was such a thing as the Czechoslovak nation, and this was a lie that was invented in order to, as it were, top up the number of Czechs in the Czechoslovak state, or the number of Slavs in the Czechoslovak state. The Anglo-Saxon statesmen accepted this lie, and if they'd bothered to look, they would have found out straight away that there was no such thing as a Czechoslovak nation, that there are Czechs and Slovaks, and then Hitler ends by saying that just ask the Slovaks, they want to have nothing to do with the Czechs. This was Hitler's argument at the time, and in a sense there's an element of truth in it. Professor Musil.
Well, this is a very difficult question. Most people now, I think, in our country, as well in Slovakia, would agree that there are two nations. But let us talk about the idea as expressed by Masaryk. He belonged to those people who believed that nations are not, as Hitler did, a product of ethnic roots, but that nations are a program that you vote, you daily vote for your nation. And he very much hoped, and I think this was his deepest conviction, political conviction, that you can shape the society by intentions.
We have to say that the idea of one nation, Czechoslovak nation, we can trace it back into the 19th century, so it was not Beneš's or Masaryk's invention in 1918. And I would like to add one more thing. The Slovak nation was heavily underdeveloped at that time, and the elite of that nation was very, very restricted, and the majority of that elite considered themselves as being Czechoslovaks. So we can definitely see that there were some arguments for a unity of Czechoslovak nation at that time, but history, as Professor Musil said, proved that they were wrong.
And there was another problem in this idea of Czechoslovakism, wasn't there, that the 3.5 million Germans in Czechoslovakia and the approximately 1 million Hungarians in the country, not to mention the smaller Ruthenian and Polish minorities, felt themselves almost automatically to be excluded from the Republic, didn't they?
The Sudeten Germans traditionally belonged to the very strong nationalistically orientated. That's one observation, and suddenly they became secondary part of it. But at the same time, as my colleague said, from 26 already, the majority of the German inhabitants in the country discovered some positive aspects. They discovered liberal democracy, I think. They discovered the economic advantages, being an organic part of a country. And if you read texts of German authors, like a wonderful author Bruegel, who wrote about the interaction between Czechs and Germans, he said he would prefer to support Czech democracy before supporting German nationalism.
You've both mentioned the name of Tomáš Garrigue Masaryk, the first Czechoslovak president, the man who's seen as the founding father of the country. He had spent time in Britain and in the United States, and he was a great admirer of the Anglo-Saxon democratic model. I've got another archive recording here from 1932, and this is President Masaryk talking about the legacy of George Washington on the 200th anniversary of his birth. And it's very clear that Washington is, for Masaryk, a role model.
I admire Washington's silent energy and perseverance. These qualities enabled him to stand the attacks of his numerous adversaries and not to lose his faith in the independence of his country after many defeats caused by the weakness of his army. Washington valued above all, as he has expressed it, the inestimable blessing of liberty. Liberty, that is the fundamental principle of the American Republic.
So that was Tomáš Garrigue Masaryk, the first Czechoslovak president, speaking in 1932 with what, from today's perspective, sounds like a very modern, democratic vision of society. Did it really take root in Czechoslovakia? Andrej?
The tragedy of Czechoslovakia is that it survived as a democratic country only for 20 years. And Masaryk always said we need at least 50 years. So it's difficult to judge. But when it comes to liberty, and Masaryk mentioned liberty several times in that speech, I think, yes, it took root in Czechoslovakia because, as we know, Czechoslovakia endured as a democracy, as the only democracy together with Finland in the Eastern Europe. So I would say, yes, among Czechs it endured. There is a question if it endured among Slovaks, among Germans.
As a sociologist, I would add, I fully agree with you, I would add some notes. Historical notes, by the way. If you look on the social structure of the Czech society, I mean Czech speaking, it is a lower middle class type of society. The core of the roots, culturally and philosophically, I would almost say, are in small towns. It's a society without aristocracy, or was a society without strong aristocracy. And it was a society which was quite early industrialized, with a strong proto-industrial roots, and a society which, thanks to the trade links to Western Europe, kept a strong small urban society. Due to these structures, there is a kind of genuine lower middle class type of democracy. And Czechs, in fact, left Austria not only for national reasons. They left them because they were modern. This was a relatively modern country, already before World War I.
But isn't there also a problem that there was a tendency to equate modernity with Czechness, and that in a multinational society, the tendency was to say, we're progressive Czechs, you other nations within the country are less progressive, therefore you need to follow our model, and that it didn't confront the complexities of living in a multinational state.
Yes, that's probably true. And there were smart Czech thinkers like Radl, who, in a book, The War Between Czechs and Germans, stressed it. Czechs were not always understanding. And don't forget the feeling of being victors. It's a very important element.
After the First World War.
Well.
I'd like to move on now to the problems that emerged after Hitler came to power, because obviously suddenly the reality on the ground changed. There was this large, aggressive country next to Czechoslovakia. Then came the annexation of Austria in March 1938, when the Czechs found themselves almost surrounded by an aggressive neighbour. I have another short extract here. This time it's a speech given by President Beneš in April 1938, just a couple of weeks after the Anschluss of Austria by Hitler, where he's talking a little bit about the complexities of the situation that Czechoslovakia finds itself in.
We must not close our eyes to the great fact which dominates our present time, that ever since the Great War, we have been experiencing one of the greatest political, social, economic and cultural revolutions which has ever taken place in the history of our continent. Will this process and development, which is characterized by tension in international politics and social revolution in internal politics, terminate in a vast new European or world war? All Europe is asking that question today. I am not blind to the seriousness of the situation, I do not want to calm you vainly and short-sightedly, nor do I desire to diffuse official optimism. A very responsible statesman and politician today cannot but realize the gravity of the situation and guide and prepare his state accordingly.
So that was Czechoslovak President Edvard Beneš speaking in April 1938. Ondřej Hořka, he is often criticized heavily for the way that he dealt with the crisis in 1938. He's often blamed for the collapse of Czechoslovakia. Do you think that the criticism of Beneš that we so often hear is fair?
It's totally unfair, in my view, because he waged the only possible policy. What was his principal strategy? His principal strategy was that the Western powers would realize that Hitler is a mortal threat also to them, not only to Czechoslovakia. And in my view, there was no other option for Czechoslovakia only to keep its faith in Western democracies, because the agreement with Hitler was not possible, and the agreement with other neighbors like Poland and Hungary was also not possible. So
what about the Soviet Union?
It was like a second option behind the French one, also for Beneš. And now we know that the Stalin strategy was very complicated, and even today we are not so sure about his strategy. So in my view, the policy of Edvard Beneš failed, that's clear, but in my view, he had no other options.
Jiří Musil, do you agree that Beneš's great misfortune was just that he was living in the wrong time?
I agree with my colleague. I think the situation was desperate, either to start a war, which he can be then accused even by the Western powers
provoking the war.
At the same time, he was convinced that there will be a great war and that it's a problem when it will start, and then a very problematic part of his decision, of course, which is most often discussed here.
You mean his decision to capitulate
To accept it, yes, or not to ask for fighting, was just a question, fighting or not, in moral terms and in long term, structuring the character of the community. And this is one element where I think the Munich Agreement caused a damage to the country. I mean the acceptance of it.
You mean that it broke, as it were, the spirit of the nation,
yes,
the will to resist
that means
and to influence its own history?
His argument was, I would say, almost explicit. I want to save lives of people. I want to save the country. Because anyway, in short time, there will be a big war. And there are, of course, people who say, but fighting would mean that the backbone of the country will be stronger in the future. But who knows? I was 10 years old. I remember the mobilization, the behavior of the people around me. And my father was as well a soldier. He was a captain in the reserve. And the support was enormous. People were prepared to die. I'm absolutely convinced. It's in my memory. Even in Slovakia, I am stressing it. I used to be in Slovakia at that time, Bratislava.
Ondřej, you were born several decades after these events. Do you still feel a wound in Czech society from the capitulation that followed the Munich Agreement?
I do not. In my view, that's a question that only intellectuals are posing themselves. To common people, it means, I would say, completely nothing. And to the majority of Czechs, the First Republic is such a golden age in our history, which is true to some extent, but we can also say that there are several myths associated with the First Republic, like, for example, that it was economically very much developed state. That's true only in some way, because the real prosperity in Czechoslovakia was only in the second half of the 20s. So I would say that, like, common people are not so much interested in the issues about which we are talking right now.
And both of you, I mean, do you think that today's Czech society is built on the foundations of the First Republic? Because the Czech Republic is lucky, in a sense, in having this tradition of a previous democratic state. To what extent do you think that today's Czech Republic has been able successfully to build on the positive qualities of the First Republic?
I'm convinced that the interwar First Czechoslovak Republic belongs to the better parts of the Czech history, and people know it. There is, however, one question: to what extent they are able to continue in this spirit. But no doubt, I think, this is a kind of message which can help us even now.
Ondřej Hoska, do you agree with that?
Well, the interwar Czechoslovakia is often blamed for excessive compromises between main political parties. What I think is that now in Czech Republic we need a little bit more compromises than we have today.
One addendum to the message. If you talk with people who went through this period, they all would stress that it was a country with optimism, with a kind of go, at least among Czech intellectuals. It was really dynamic, and the spirit, if I compare it from my own perspective, I don't see such element in the contemporary Czech society, so we have a lot of things to learn from that period.
And Ondřej, you're about to go off to Brussels to be a correspondent for Czech radio there in Brussels. Do you think that the First Republic offers the Czech Republic today maybe some models or some lessons as it takes over the European Union presidency next year?
Well, perhaps, and it's a paradox that Beneš is often blamed for excessive politics on European level. No, that's a complete misunderstanding. He was a great politician in that sense, and we should all learn to have a European perspective as well, and that will come, I hope, with our presidency.
Anyway, thank you very much indeed, sociology professor Jiří Musil and journalist and historian Ondřej Hoska, for joining us in the studio and for talking about the first Czechoslovak Republic. I think we've heard some fascinating insights over the last 20 minutes into the history of Czechoslovakia, of its first 20 years. I hope that we'll see you again sometime soon in our studio.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
It was a pleasure to be here with you.
And that brings our program today to an end. If you'd like to write to us, you can write to Radio Prague, 12099 Prague, the Czech Republic. And you can also find this program in audio and text on our website, which is www.radio.cz. From me, David Vaughan, and all of us here, goodbye.